Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Nature Now for the first week of July with Mary Robson. Intermittent rain helped our plants in June, and now we look forward to heading into full, warm summer. Today, we'll identify and discuss a few troublesome local noxious weeds with Joost Bessen. The mystery sound is a sea mammal. The young squeak like kittens, and this sound is an adult who seems disturbed. Now some observations with our usual great help from Charlie Fleischman.
A blooming beauty, the billowy white flowers visible now have the common name ocean spray. The name perfectly describes clusters of white covering the shrubs. Ocean spray grows in open, sunny sites. Edges of roads fill with it. Look quickly, because the blooms rapidly become tea-colored, a soft brown that's nearly invisible. Nesting bush tits choose ocean spray. The many brown seeds provide winter food for birds. Ocean spray did not disappear or disappoint when it came to uses for the wood. Coiled ironwood, it was valued for strength. It made spear and harpoon shafts, bows and arrows, and even chest armor, used by virtually all coastal groups. The wood, already strong, was heated and then polished with horsetail stems. The Cowichan used it for halibut hooks, bark scrapers, and later, even knitting needles. Before nails were available, ocean spray pegs were used in construction. Information is from Pojar and McKinnon, Plants of Coastal British Columbia.
Lizards. Lizards generally choose to live in warm, dry areas. But one appears here, described as the only lizard found in the coastal strip of Washington, the northern alligator lizard. They live in coniferous forest edges, clear cuts, under logs, in cool, moist spots, and they can also tolerate areas of low to moderate development, including rock retaining walls, woody debris, rock piles. The lizard I saw scooting behind a rock wall on one of the warmer June days was moving too fast to see clearly, but its 4-inch length and brown patterned back matches descriptions of the alligator lizard. The tail is often longer than the body. Reptiles do not migrate and hibernate through the coldest months, making their homes in tree trunks, rocks, and wherever they can find shelter. Lizards are cold-blooded ectotherms with no internal heating capabilities, so they must rely on heat from external sources. And when winter comes, they're forced into hibernation. These lizards become active again in March and April. Seeing reptiles and amphibians seems to me to define the sturdiness of animals against development. The northern alligator is considered of least concern due to, quote, their ability to tolerate some forms of habitat destruction, their large distribution, and numerous large stable populations. If you observe a lizard while you're walking on the Olympic Peninsula at low elevations, it's most likely this one. Information from the Burke Museum and the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife.
There's good news from the OrcaNet observers, and we quote, along with the abundance of whale reports and beautiful images, we too share some extra bright news. Yesterday, the 29th, while jays and elves were foraging in Juan de Fuca off Sook, British Columbia, K-Pod was heading south down the west coast of Vancouver Island. It has been a long while since we've had word of K's, and become such a rarity to hear about the residents, especially about all three pods on the same day. We greatly appreciate this news shared by the Whale Center in Tofino, British Columbia. We hope K-Pod continue to come to Inland Salish Sea, the place which historically has been the core summer habitat for jays, K's, and L's. We hope, too, one day soon, there is enough Chinook salmon to afford the entire clan even one day together to feed together and socialize. But even more, we are at the point we have to hope they can find Chinook salmon to feed all their bellies wherever they go.
And for clarity, a pod is an extended family of orcas. The southern resident killer whales, SRKW, or orcas, are actually a large extended family or clan comprised of three pods, given letters J, K, and L pods. Within each pod, families form into subpods centered around older females, usually grandmothers or great-grandmothers. Both male and female offspring remain in close association with their mothers for life. Each southern resident pod uses a characteristic dialect of calls to communicate. Certain calls are common between all three pods, the J, K, and L. The calls used by the southern resident community are unlike the calls used by any other community of killer whales. These calls can travel 10 miles or more underwater. The material is from the Orca Network and the British Columbia Killer Whale Research Report. I'm here talking with Jost Bessen, who is the coordinator for the Jefferson County Noxious Weed Control Board. There's all those words, and every one of them works. We talked at length in June about the noxious weed that is poison hemlock, and what I would like to do now is talk again about some that are bothersome, but not necessarily poisonous, but very much present in our area here. So this is looking at the local. I know that we talked about the fact that the Weed Board mission is to survey, to do education outreach, and then enforcement if it becomes necessary or is possible. And what I'm wondering is, with all of the detail that you deal with, what absorbs most of your work time?
Sometimes I get a phone call from private people, even public agencies, and they say, oh, you're the Weed Board. Can you please come and take care of my weeds? And so
I'm going to have a party, and it's right. Kind of messy around here. Get your people out.
Right. And so currently I'm one person. And what a Weed Board does is that we try and coordinate noxious weed control countywide. Mm-hmm. And so noxious weeds, as you know, aren't very worried about boundaries. Mm-hmm. Which can be a big issue if one landowner takes care of their weeds, but the other ones around them don't, and his property or her property will get reinfested year after year. Mm-hmm. Most of my time goes to, I'd say, probably targeted education and targeted meetings with land managers, decision makers, county commissioners, right. City council, and basically try to explain to them the importance of noxious weed control, freeing up money for noxious weed control, and just putting it somewhere on the list of priorities mm-hmm. of all the things that county and city government has to deal with.
Right. This one might be easy not to worry with if it's not happening on your property. You've got livestock to take care of, and you're trying to keep a healthy pasture. And it could be not doing well at all because of noxious weeds. So why can't somebody just easily revegetate when the noxious weeds have been removed? I mean, just say, okay, fine, we're going to plant something here and no trouble from now on.
Well, there's rarely a silver bullet in noxious weed control. One of the biggest issues is a seedbed. So if an infestation has been somewhere for a while, it will have a seedbed. And so once the weeds have been removed, the seeds are happy because now it's their chance. And so
they've got a nice little bumpy spot to be in.
Exactly.
That, when I think of Scott's broom, it's just kind of a constant seedbed being created all over the county practically.
And then another issue that sometimes ties into it is that revegetation can be ideal, you know, in a yard or mm-hmm. a nice garden. But if you're looking at, for example, right-of-way, which is usually a big vector of noxious weeds, is that there's other priorities to keep in mind, such as road visibility or road damage. And so you mm-hmm. can't really plant whatever you want. There's got to be something there that works.
You have to protect sight lines for people driving and that kind of thing.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
We were talking about a seed bed. Do some of these seeds survive for a long, long time? I think you mentioned Scotch broom, which sticks around for how long?
80 years. and maybe even longer, but there have been
studies. It outlives us then, right? Oh my gosh.
And you know, that's under good conditions, but there have been studies where they found Scotch broom seeds remaining viable under the soil for up to 80 years, yes.
And it was brought here as an ornamental and for erosion control, something like that. I mean, there was some reason why we needed it.
Right. I heard of ornamental too, and that's actually the case for many noxious weeds. They are brought in either as ornamentals or some other use.
Let's talk about a couple of the other ones that can be bothering the noxious weed board and possibly people who are either trying to hike or homeowners. Let's start with giant hogweed. It's not so hard to identify, but you could get it confused with poison hemlock, probably, right?
Yeah, you could. I think one of the bigger lookalikes is cow parsnip.
Okay, which is not a noxious weed, right?
No, it's not a nice plant, but it's not a noxious weed.
It didn't have a good upbringing.
Right.
Right. Okay, so giant hogweed is not internally toxic, but it can really bother people. If you ate a leaf of giant hogweed, you would not be in as bad shape as if you ate a leaf of poison hemlock.
I think you'd be in a really bad shape still with giant hogweed. I'm actually not sure, but I do know that the sap of giant hogweed can cause severe blistering and permanent skin damage. Even after several years, after coming in touch with that sap, your skin will remain photosensitive.
So let's say you're not wearing a hat and it's a sunny day, you're not protected. You've just sliced off a piece of giant hogweed and gotten the sap on your wrist and your cheeks, perhaps, and then continued sun exposure, you'll get rashes. It's not a rash, though. It looks worse than a rash.
Yeah, it can be severe blistering and burns.
Yeah, so it almost looks like a burn from a match.
And even several years later, after never having seen another giant hogweed, it will still flare up in the sun again.
Aye, aye, aye. To describe it, it's taller than almost any of the other weeds we're talking about, right?
Yeah, it can grow very tall, 15 feet easy. Whereas that's one thing with the cow parsnip, rarely goes over 8. But size is rarely a very trustworthy identification tool, I'd say. Some plants can be really happy somewhere and kind of grow into the
Right, depends
freak of
on
nature.
The resources available to the
right.
plant. Someone said that things grow to the limit of the least available resource. In other words, if it never gets water, then that's the least available resource and it'll grow shorter. But giant hogweed does have, again, these fluffy white flowers that are almost shaped like an open umbrella.
Yeah.
They're up there. It has purple spots, but this is where the hairs come in, right? That giant hogweed is covered with prickly hairs.
Right.
And really, this is one I just would absolutely take as much care as you possibly can not to get it on yourself, period.
Yeah, yeah.
It will grow, I read, in a flood or in drought conditions. So what you're trying to do is get it out before it seeds, if you possibly can.
Yes, absolutely. Giant hogweed is a Class A noxious weed in the state, and so it means that if you find it, all plant material needs to be removed.
And again, treated like the poison hemlock, where you're bagging it and not putting it in a compost pile or starting a children's dwelling with decorated with giant hogweed. And it's another one that came in here as an ornamental, yes?
Yeah, because they're so giant. They're a pretty imposing plant. The flower heads can be 2 feet wide. The leaves can be 3 to 5 feet wide.
Wow.
It has that name for a reason. It is a giant plant.
And it does have prickly hairs, and you really don't want to get this, as I said, you don't want to get it on your skin. And that's actually probably why it's a noxious weed, because it's really dangerous for people. I don't know about animals, but it's really dangerous for people. There are also, as we said last time, very good bulletins which will show you what it looks like. And because we're moving toward the middle of June and the 1st of July, if they're there, they will be getting pretty big. Yeah?
Yes.
Well, the next thing that we run into is tansy ragwort. Some tansies are garden plants. Tansy ragwort isn't. It does look like a small daisy. But the problem with that one is not so much people, but it affects what?
Cattle and livestock. horses.
Okay, so if it got into a pasture, you'd have alkaloids bothering your cattle, your horses.
Yeah, and I'd say a bigger problem would probably be if it gets into your hay. So horses and cows will generally not start eating tansy ragwort if it's growing out there and they have enough other food.
However, so if it was fresh, but say somebody mowed it and made it into hay.
Yeah, it remains toxic as hay.
Oh my.
And if animals do eat it, then what happens is that these toxins build up in the liver. And so you won't really see any symptoms of tansy poisoning until it's usually too late.
Ooh. And this is one that reproduces from both seeds and root fragments. I read a King County publication that said 150,000 seeds per plant. Is that even feasible?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a few weeds that go up in the millions of seeds, yeah.
Don't be discouraged, listeners. We're taking these things one at a time carefully, right.
That also means that when you remove one plant, you remove 150,000 seeds,
okay,
which feels
very good.
Yeah.
Tansy isn't very tall.
No, about 1 to 4 feet.
I've never seen one that tall, but I guess it's okay. Yeah. I'm thinking of it as being sort of knee high.
Yeah.
There are some growing on a gravel driveway into my house. It's not there anymore because I took it out, but it came from someplace. Anyway, that's one that is important to know, especially if you have a pasture for horses. The alkaloids are just not really good. And then we have Japanese knotweed. I spent a long time in my son's garden in Boston digging Japanese knotweed. It is awful. And why do we worry about it?
Well, Japanese knotweed can completely take over waterways. And so it is a big problem in West Jefferson County. There's a lot of work being done there as well. And then in East Jefferson County.
So over toward the Ho?
Yes.
Okay.
In that area. Then also in East Jefferson County, there's work being done. It's less spread out here, but we do have big infestations. The big problem about Japanese knotweed is it just proliferates in basically any way. It makes the seeds and everything, but the biggest problem is that it can regrow from about a 1-inch plant fragment. So you have these plants growing huge amounts of biomass.
Dad.
And with roots up to 30 feet deep in gravelly.
I heard that correctly, yes.
Right.
Yeah, right.
30 feet
10
deep,
meters or so. We've got, oh my gosh.
And then they're growing in a gravelly riverbed.
They can get water everywhere.
Yeah, and then if a stream undercuts that gravel bed and chops up the roots, then you just have little root fragments that start to regrow into new plants. If you take care of this plant in the wrong way, which is basically, you know, if you try to mow it or chop it, you're literally creating thousands more little plants. And if that gets into the river, it gets
wants you
out.
To do that.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Is there any effective way to work with it?
Well, small infestations, if you're very careful and you make sure you get everything, you can dig it out, but you gotta go deep often. For me, the best way to take care of these would be herbicide.
Okay.
And so the way that I view herbicide is as a last resort. And I've heard a metaphor of somebody comparing it to chemotherapy. You don't do that for a cold. It's a serious thing.
Don't.
You know, you do it for a big problem.
Right.
And in some cases, you can view noxious weeds as a cancer growing in an ecosystem. And so using an herbicide is not fun, and I wouldn't want to do it. But at the same time, having Japanese knotweed outcompete all your native species, destroy your salmon habitat, take over riverbanks, destroy native plants and everything is also not fun.
And so, I've turned a funny color, like sort of a pale green here, because that just sounds terrible. I've only seen it in landscape situations where it was brought in because it's pretty. It looks a little like asparagus when it's growing. And I think I remember reading long, long ago that the very young sprouts used to be eaten.
Yeah, apparently they have an asparagus taste.
Not to my...
No.
No.
And, you know, that's one thing. Sometimes you'll see people, they try to come up with creative ways of utilizing a noxious weed so it can be controlled. And with knotweed, it was we can eat the knotweed. It can be a double-edged sword because now you're also using or promoting a plant that really should be eradicated.
And there aren't enough of us in Jefferson County to eat all the available knotweed, no matter how much garlic butter we put on it.
Right.
It's just... the new shoots are a little tempting, but not very, very much. So this is a tough one, and... Just to end today, because we could, believe me, we could keep going on this subject for months, but you talked with me about wild chervil, and that is a plant I don't know anything about. I don't think I've ever encountered it. You said it's growing in agricultural chimicum.
Right.
Invasive and not palatable.
Right. Yeah, so wow. Wild chervil was brought in, as far as we know, in a wildflower seed mix into the States. And
boy,
it can completely take over. It's very aggressive. It's one of the few weeds that can invade healthy native ecosystems, nearly unpalatable for wildlife and cattle.
So a cow is not going to be doing well if it's gotten into the pasture.
No. Basically what it does, it greatly reduces the carrying capacity of a wildlife area. And I've seen photos where the undergrowth or the understory of a forest is 100% wild chervil. There's nothing else growing there.
Right. And there isn't anything from a weasel to a beaver to a deer that can eat it and be nourished.
No, not as far as I know. And so the thing in Jefferson County, wild chervil is growing in the right-of-way as well as on a few private properties. And then in Chimicum, it's a big issue because there's a lot of cattle there, mm-hmm. as well as hay farmers. And chervil can also, when it gets put into hay, it usually stays wet for a little longer and cause rot in the hay. So that's another, for hay farmers, it's also a big problem.
This topic has given me a great deal of respect for a solid, good pasture.
Absolutely.
It really has. I am very grateful that you have been here. And the main message from my point of view of this talk is that informative websites and publications are available on all these weeds and more. I think if anyone is landscaping for a living, they need a noxious weed list that they carry around with and laminate and look at it closely. So is there anything else you would like to add from the noxious weed board perspective?
The landscaping is definitely an interesting thing. Always be aware of where you get your materials from, especially if you're getting gravel, soil, compost, all that stuff.
They could be full of seeds.
It could be full of seeds. Always be very aware of that. When you see plants that are behaving very dominant or just don't look nice, although a lot of weeds are very pretty, if you just wonder about something, you can always call us or email me or walk into my office. We have a lot of resources available. Keep in mind that different plants require very different control strategies. Right. If you mow the wrong thing, you've proliferated it. And so it's not a one silver bullet for all. It needs different approaches.
And it does start with getting acquainted with what you're looking at and seeing in your neighborhood or somebody else's neighborhood.
If it's one plant, it's very simple and quick. If it's 1,000 plants, it is sometimes nearly undoable.
Okay. Thank you so much, Joost. It's a fascinating subject.
Right.
It's just that, wow.
The best thing for noxious weeds is early detection, rapid response.
Okay.
You find them early and you do something.
And that means that back in March and April is a good place to start.
For some species.
For some, yeah. That's where we are. And we have enjoyed this in a kind of quirky way. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
Well, all of that gets us up to identifying the mystery sound. Which is a sea otter. A lot of you may have noticed that.
A magnificent mammal, the sea otter is completely adapted to life at sea. They mate, give birth, eat and sleep in nearshore marine waters. Larger than the river otter, both males and females grow to about 4 feet. The males can weigh up to 100 pounds, females about 45. Unlike other sea mammals, they have no blubber to protect them from cold. Their luxurious fur keeps them alive, but also led to overhunting that nearly eliminated Pacific coastal populations during the 19th and 20th century. In 1911, they were given treaty protection from hunting, but by then they were almost extinct along the Oregon and Washington coast.
Their fur has long waterproof outer hairs that help keep the undercoat from allowing water to reach the skin. That would probably prove fatal. The undercoat is dense, more dense than any other mammal. Soft brown, it has up to 1 million hairs per square inch of skin. I had to read that 4 times before being certain. It is actual. Grooming fur must continue daily all the otter's life. Their fur fits loosely, and their skeleton flexes so they can reach all parts of their pelt. Loose, pocket-like areas allow stashing a catch while continuing to hunt. An otter must consume approximately 25% of its body weight in prey each day just to stay alive. A 75-pound otter can eat up to 1,500 sea urchins a day, or about 25 pounds of seafood. If feeding a pup, a female requires even more. And now for some events. This is a busy week. It's July 4th. And on July 4th, the Audubon Dungeness Center will have a bird walk, 8:30 to 10:30. Meet at the River Center. Seems like a good way to start the July holiday. July 5th, also the Audubon Dungeness Center, every Thursday, 10 a.m., an all-outdoor teacher-led adventure for children and adults. Well, we hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic, live, and eclectic reports. Thanks to Charlie Fleischman for engineering our words and our sounds. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Podcasts are also available on the website at www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Weeds, performed by Michael Penn.
Always on the job. An honest person was a picture of you that made it seem. And he, oft times he'd pull it out, gaze into and drift about. That looked into one man saw a tower high, another saw the flowers in the weeds.